Game over?
No way!
Because we got Game Genie.
We tell you when it's over.
With Game Genie, I decide how many lives I get.
I use it when I want to live forever.
Play to the end and win. Maybe I want to start on level 15.
No problemo.
It makes cool games like Street Fighter 2
more exciting.
Less frustrating.
With Game Genie, it ain't over.
So we say it's over.
Excellent!
Game Genie for NES, Super NES, Sega Genesis, and Game Boy. Codes for many popular games, each sold separately.
Welcome to the Autofire Power Hour. Ray.
Brian.
Oh, it is nice to be in your cooked up, heated up garage. It feels real warm in an otherwise cold evening.
Yeah, we got a cooking here.
Yeah, and you know, it's bullshit because outside's super cold.
It's really cold.
Our gentle bodies are not used to actual cold.
And by cold, we mean like, you know, mid-50s.
Yeah.
Being in California, yeah. Like that kills us.
Well, and it's shockingly cold for us.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. That's the disaster that we're currently facing.
Yeah, we both had to put on hoodies today and we're upset about it.
I'm pretty mad. I have a fucking sweet, you can tell the people, you can verify this, Ray. I have a pretty sweet Heather purple, not Heather gray, Heather purple. It's got a fucking an alien, like a gray alien on it, and a bunch of space around it.
It's freaking awesome.
I bought the shirt for $4.84 at Walmart. Very proud of it. Yeah. And I haven't yet been stopped on the street by like a believer to sit there and talk about UFOs. That's why I bought it.
That's disappointing.
That's why I bought it. So that I can walk around and like go to various AMPMs
super disappointing.
And hopefully be stopped by somebody who's going to be like, what's your experience, brother?
But how many AMPMs have you hit up?
Today?
Really? Yeah.
17.
17.
Yeah.
You got known. You got no believers.
I know. It's bullshit. It's absolutely inaccurate.
Yeah. It's not what I would have expected.
Right. But enough alien talk. We're here today to do, this is a long in gestation episode that you and I have been talking about doing for a long time.
God, we've wanted to do this for a long time.
But like we, you know, full disclosure, we just didn't want to put together notes because this one requires it. It requires like a lot of notes because we're talking today about Codemasters.
Yep.
And Codemasters, you know, like if you actually look into it, like they have this really long, like really fucking long history in video games. And like, you know, today they're mostly known for like they're one of the standard bearers for the racing genre.
Yep.
But
the F1, the formula games.
Yeah. Also like the rally games like Dirt, the grid games, the grid series. And we'll get to all those when we kind of go through like what they're responsible for. But then the other way I think people know Codemasters, if you grew up in Europe, especially particularly in the UK, you're certainly familiar with like their computer output, their Amiga and the Spectrum and all that bullshit. Stuff that we just didn't really have the same type of access of as our friends across the drink, as they say, did. But then they did a lot of 8-bit stuff that we're all going to get into. But before we get into it, and you're going to drive that train, you're going to be the engineer of this Codemasters locomotive.
I'm ready.
But let's talk a little bit about like what's your personal experience with Codemasters.
Codemasters, especially when we were doing our research for this podcast,
mm-hmm.
It was really surprising to me to kind of really dive into it because Codemasters in the UK, I mean, they just signed like one of the largest media deals for video games with like the Motorsport channel of the EU.
And you're talking about like this is recent
modern
stuff.
Codemasters,
like today's Codemasters,
right? But to get to that point, mm-hmm. you don't get to that point without having an impact.
Sure.
And yet, like, my experience with Codemasters growing up was on the NES and Genesis.
Right.
And they were kind of doing some shady things back then.
Yeah. We'll say low bar kind of low quality shit.
Yes. They, like, you know, they were the king of the unlicensed games.
Yes.
They were the king.
Certainly one of them.
Of breaking lock chips in systems.
They said, whoa, you want us to pay money to make a game? No. What we're going to go ahead and do is fucking figure this shit out.
And we've been waiting to do Codemasters for so long because of that history and our experience with them when they were starting out. We've had nothing but admiration for them, obviously, because that's the kind of people that we are.
For sure.
And my first experience, I actually had mentioned on the show before.
Yeah, at a previous episode, we talked about it.
Where my mom was, you know, I only got like one game a year or something at Christmas. And my mom was so... I was always angry that I would like beat everything that she bought like within a day or two.
Oh yeah,
right. And so she bought me Quattro Sports, which was a Codemaster game for the NES. And because her reasoning was, well, this has four games.
Yes.
So it's going to take him at least 12 days to beat them all.
That was the reasoning of the Quattro things to exist. It was like, well, these have four games.
Yeah.
End of discussion.
So, and we had actually talked about Quattro Sports on, I think, on another episode where like the BMX game on that.
Yeah. By the time this episode is in the channel, that one had already aired. So we will have known your rich history with Quattro Sports.
So that was my main thing. And then the only other game maybe I would mention as another big impact was the Micro Machine games on the Genesis.
Yeah. Yes.
Because I loved those games.
Yes. So that's for me as a childhood wise, it was the Micro Machine games. But like, you know, back then you don't really like with the exception of like a big, like a Konami or a Capcom, even like Acclaim, like those are names that I like would recognize as a kid, as like, you know, either synonymous with quality or in the case of Acclaim, synonymous with not such good quality
with stuff.
But like Codemasters is just one of those ones that it never really like stuck into the memory vaults for me, with the sole exception of the Game Genie, because on the splash screen, especially for like the 16-bit ones, it says, you know, Game Genie by Codemasters or whatever. And always that name always stuck out to me because it's like, hell yeah, you're the Codemasters.
Yeah.
The Cheat Codemasters. but then...
And what an appropriate name to have to have develop the Game Genie.
Yes.
when your company's name is Codemasters.
Yeah. And this is, it's like a forgotten art, but like, you know, we cheats used to be called codes, and that was a wonderful thing.
Yeah,
and those are gone. Thank you, DLC.
Now you just buy loot boxes.
Yeah. Now you just gamble and it's the exact same thing, but not more recently for me, it was the racing games, particularly the Grid series. I'm a big fan of Grid. Grid is like are you familiar with it at all?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so Grid,
not enough to say that I am.
Okay, so what I love about those games is that they straddle the line of simulation racing, but have more than enough arcade stuff so that I actually enjoy playing them.
Okay.
So, and that's like a kind of a theme in the newer Codemasters stuff, which oh god,
let it out.
Let me readjust. like with the exception of the F1 stuff, because I'm not gonna play that.
No,
but I played a lot of their I played a lot of their rally stuff, which is super arcadey, super fun, and then Grid, of course. And it really is, you know, there's not, Sega hasn't really given us a good racing game in a while. Even Namco, like Namco, will come out with like a Ridge Racer once every like 10 years,
right?
So there's just not a lot going on in that genre, and Codemasters is kind of like the torchbearer of it.
Well, totally, and we'll get into a little bit of that, I think, later in the Codemasters story, because there's an interesting story between the Sega Arcade team that eventually was created in Europe, and then what happened to them, and then where Codemaster games were.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
But that being said, we should probably just roll into kind of where Codemasters.
Let's do it.
Started.
Let's dive right in.
Brothers, Richard and David Darling.
Oh, so you're telling me right now, across from this table, that one of the guys who founded Codemasters, Richard Darling, Dick Darling.
Yeah.
Dick Darling.
Yeah, Dick Darling.
That is fucking incredible. What a handle.
Dick Darling is the founder of Codemasters.
Oh, yeah. You know, I kind of feel like, you know, it's 2019. We probably shouldn't say Dick Darling. But this is a fact. This is a verifiable fact. Dick is, of course, short for Richard. Richard Darling, henceforth, Dick Darling. David Darling, not so cool. Not so cool.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I see your point. Although I would say that, you know, if I was trying to come up with the name of a guy who came up with a company called Codemasters.
Dick Darling's your guy.
Dick Darling would probably be like, you know. Dick Darling would have made a company.
Okay, think of it like this. So a guy wearing like a fucking green tweed suit who's sold your mom a shitty four-pack of crappy NES games. What's that guy's name?
Yeah, Dick Darling.
It's Dick Darling. It's a dude all day long. Dick Darling is your man. He's going to package four games in one.
Yeah.
He's going to sell it at high top dollar value.
Yeah, you go to the corner, you grab your four game in one package.
Yeah.
And there's always a homeless guy sitting over there calling him Double D.
Exactly. What What up, Double D?
Hey, Double D!
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And then at
shut up, Steve.
3 p.m., he hops in his orange Datsun and just moves.
Fourth pack games here.
Just hops in that Datsun and moves on next to, yeah, to the next parking lot. Dick
Steve,
darling.
Steve, you're scaring away the clientele. So Dick and Dave went to... they actually went to school in Vancouver.
Okay.
That's kind of where they sort of started messing around. But, like, the whole company was kind of founded on making some games for specific PC engines.
Okay.
Where they would actually, in the great tradition of Codemasters, redevelop games like Galaxian and Defender and then release them out on PC.
Okay.
Gonna go out on a limb and say that those were also unlicensed.
Yeah.
But I don't have proof of that.
I think it's fair that Dick Darling is just gonna do whatever it takes to make his games happen.
Yeah, Double D's releasing this.
Yeah.
He's
releasing it all right.
Whether Big Brother says so or not.
It's the Codemasters difference.
That is. So anyways, they were somewhat successful from that perspective.
Right.
So kind of going into the 90s, and this is just kind of like a common theme for them, mm-hmm. like throughout their early years, is they just released shovelware.
Yes.
Over and over and over. And not only their own shovelware, right. other people's shovelware.
Yeah, they became like kind of like a middleman between like, hey, you got some shit? Hey, we could polish that shit, put it out on a Commodore.
Yeah.
Just see what happens.
So like if you ever order like knockoff computer parts from China.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, these are the knockoff video game computer parts from China.
Right.
Before that existed.
Before that was a thing.
Yeah.
And it was happening in the UK by way of Canada.
So, but their first legit game was BMX Simulator, mm-hmm. which is on Quattro Sports.
Yes.
And that game is a legit fun game.
Of the four, it's the most tolerable, for sure.
Yeah. So, and the other funny fact that I found about this company is, like, during this time,
mm-hmm.
They were interested in releasing as much shovelware as they could.
Right.
And their standard was to release games at half the price as licensed games.
Yes.
And they started actually outsourcing programming to other people to release more content for half the price, undercutting the market as fast as they could.
Dick, motherfucking darling.
So, and at the end of kind of what I'm going to call like the early era, they started working with Comerica.
Right.
And why they started working with Comerica is because the NES in the late 80s was starting to get really popular, and they wanted to find a way to release unlicensed cheap games
because
there as well.
It's the Codemasters way. So,
yeah.
Comerica, we should, I'll jump in here just to give a little background on Comerica. Comerica was the Canadian, it was a Canadian company. That like handled it was kind of in like the souvenir business for lack of a better term, but then they navigated towards video games because like a lot of companies they took notice of this second wave of video games with the NES and they jumped in there. So the relationship with Comerica and Codemasters was one where like that's how we got Quattro Sports released out here, because Codemasters, like, you know, we're still in like the rudimentary stages of the company.
Yep.
Like now they have a fucking shit ton of money and they're like a publisher. But back then they had to work with other, you know, they had to get their unique wares into the hands of the people by any means necessary.
Well, and they were even outsourcing programming to develop games because they couldn't release the unlicensed shovelware fast enough.
Yes, exactly. So, but with Comerica's involvement, they were basically just a North American distributor that had this relationship with Codemasters. So, and what we were talking about earlier with like how Codemasters was like figuring out ways to, like, you know, basically fuck with the NES's lockout chips.
Yep.
You know, that came through in a variety of different ways. Like the most famous example of this was the Game Genie. The Game Genie has a way to zap the lockout chip.
Yeah. So what Codemasters had developed was this thing called the Power Pack.
Right.
And the Power Pack basically not only were they releasing games that had built-in code to basically break the lockout chip in Nintendo.
Well, the games had hard switches. Some of them had hard switches on them, where you would depending on what system that you had, you would physically toggle a switch when you turned your NES on to be able to play these games.
Right.
And what the switch was doing was sending a tiny low-level bit of voltage that was like goes straight to the lockout chip, and it just basically put it on the fucking Fritz.
Yeah.
So that the game would boot up and play. Yeah, it's it's total Dick Darling business. That's what it is.
They fry your NES and you can play their games.
Yeah.
So then later they developed the Power Pack, which essentially allowed you to kind of do the same thing except to the game cartridges. And then Comerica took this, rebranded it to the Game Genie.
Right.
And that's probably what they're most known for in the U.S.
At this time, yeah, for sure. And so the Power Pack is basically, it was, they came up with the Game Genie. That's what it was. But they named it the Power Pack, and then they sold that technology to Comerica. And then Comerica comes in, and they license now they have the Game Genie. That gets licensed out to Galoob. And so what kind of ties everything together with Codemasters is Galoob is the toy manufacturer that was responsible for Micro Machines.
Right.
Codemasters were the developers of Micro Machines, the games. And so it's like this like real fun circle of money that's happening here. But where it gets really... So first of all, before we get into like the lawsuit stuff.
Dude, before we talk about the Game Genie, which I can't wait to, I want to first talk about the pre-Game Genie lockout stuff that they did. The one part that I want to talk about is that the actual physical cartridges were always misshapen on all of their games. They weren't the correct standard size.
Okay.
So, that's another like really sweet part about Codemaster NES games, at least, is that not only are you kind of frying your NES... but the cartridge itself, you're kind of finessing into your system without breaking it.
Now, are you referring to like the shell of the cartridge,
yes,
or like the PCB or
the
both?
physical shell of the cartridge?
Okay, so like you're like Quattro, for example.
Yeah,
looks like an NES cartridge. It's gold,
but when you put it in there, it like kind of doesn't fit.
Okay,
so like you really got to go through like an effort to play these games.
Well, I would posit this to you, sir, good sir. We know these products aren't super on the level out of the gate.
They're not.
Would you say, or maybe would you believe that like one Quattro game that you go to buy from Dick Darling one day is a different size than another, but it's the same thing? So
yes.
Meaning like maybe they were like...
Oh, for sure that happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I used to own Quattro Adventures back when I was collecting NES games like in the early 2000s.
Okay.
And I had no issues whatsoever.
It fit
with
in
mine.
Perfectly.
Fit in perfectly.
Dude, I almost guarantee you that Codemasters was just going around to whoever could print these things. And it's just like... And month to month, they were just going manufacturer.
Yep.
Well, hey, this guy said he could do it for, you know, $2 a cartridge.
Well,
what can you do?
I mean, like, obviously these things aren't like, I don't personally have the memory that you do because you actually got one of these. I bought,
right.
Like I said, I bought one later on at like, and probably at like either a mom and pop store or like a thrift store or something.
Sure.
But like, I totally can imagine these things being like, I don't want to say like runaway smash hits because they weren't, but like I could see them being sold pretty readily, you know what I mean? Because exactly like what your mom was all about with it was like, I don't know anything about fucking video games, but this is four games in one thing. That's and it's fucking it's Comerica / Codemasters, and they're charging you like $39.99 for it.
It's half the price,
right?
It's four times the game.
Yes,
win.
All wins. That's the Dick Darling method of life. Triple win.
It's a great business.
It's a great business model.
Yeah.
So that's
hey, Codemaster is still around, and there's a lot of video game developers we talk about on the show that are not.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
But I think to your point though, like these things maybe like were probably like made in batches of a couple thousand at a time. I'm just speculating here, just pulling shit out of my ass.
No, those are accurate numbers.
Yeah, those are just absolutely fucking blue sky accurate numbers. But, you know, like one factory in China shuts down and then they go to another one.
Yeah.
And I can see where like there'd be size differences in the cartridge because these are, at the end of the day, totally unlicensed shitty products.
So listen, take note, listener. Because if you're the one person that goes out and catalogs all the different cartridge sizes of Codemaster games, you might increase all of their value by at least 50 cents.
At least, at a bare minimum.
If I can tell that this is Model 3 Quattro Sports, it might be a dollar more eBay.
You should totally just like go out and become like the Quattro guy and like do like really exhaustive fucking like
research
on the make and model of each one of these
things. Like find the emptied out factory in China that made them.
Ray, I really, really want to get to Game Genie. I'm a huge fan of Game Genie, and that's why I want to. That was like my main reason for wanting to do a Codemasters episode. But before we move on to that, one brief mention that should be made is, and it's along the lines of the context of the Quattro shit. They came out with the Aladdin Deck Enhancer, I believe is what it was called.
Right.
And it's very similar in overall design to a Game Genie, where you like plug in a cartridge into a thing and then put the thing into your NES.
Right.
But this thing was marketed to be like an extra, like upgrading your NES. It came out in the, I think, early 90s. I want to say like 91, 92, 93, somewhere in there. And like you would plug in these like oddly shaped cartridges into this device that goes in your NES. The device is doing the Codemasters difference, which is zapping the lockout chip.
It's a deck enhancer.
Right. It's a deck enhancer. And it's made by the Dick Enhancer, Dick Darling.
It's the Double D Deck Enhancer.
It's the Double D Deck Enhancer. That's what they fucking should have called it.
That is
the Double D Deck Enhancer.
Where did they come up with Aladdin?
Assholes.
They had the best name right in front of
them. That's Comerica. I bet Comerica came up with that. And Dick Darling was like, what?
Yeah, they vetoed the DD in front
of
the Deck Enhancer.
Hard veto.
Yeah.
but yeah, this thing didn't really, you know, do much other than it was another way to release unlicensed games. And the other big thing that follows the same Codemasters difference is they could sell you cheaper games. So these games that were weirdly shaped would go in the Deck Enhancer, and those games were, I believe, like $19.99 a piece, $29.99, somewhere in there. They only came out with 7 games for it, and like the standout, and I say standout very loosely. it's not really a true standout, but they Dizzy is this character made by the Oliver twins, who are like these famous brothers who programmed for Commodore and Amiga and stuff like that. Dizzy was one of their mascot characters, and he's basically like an egg, like he's like a Humpty Dumpty.
Yeah,
it obviously never caught on huge here, but in some circles in the UK. Dizzy's very fondly remembered.
Yeah.
And so this was like the Trojan horse, so to speak, of like getting the Aladdin adapter into homes.
Yeah, and actually like during this part of like the Codemaster history, like they were outsourcing a lot of these games.
Yeah.
And like if you go through their catalog of games that were being released in the '80s,
right.
You wouldn't recognize them coming from the US.
Yeah.
But they're recognizable in Europe.
Oh, for sure.
In a lot of countries.
Yes.
Another thing they did was the J-Cart, mm-hmm. which I think is super interesting because they didn't want to, because they're making unlicensed games,
right?
They didn't want to be tied down to like having their customers do something silly like buy a 4-player adapter for the Genesis.
Well, because they're not seeing a fucking dime on that.
Yeah. They don't get any cut.
They don't get a cut on that.
That's just limiting their market as far as they're concerned.
Right.
So they released J-Cart games that allowed you to plug controllers into the cartridge itself.
Yes.
So that you can play 4 players.
Right, and I had a shitty tennis game that did this. But wasn't also a Genesis Micro Machines had this too, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
There was a few of them.
Yeah, I always used to see those and thought it was so fucking neat. It's such a neat idea.
Yeah.
And like, so a calling card, we could say. We've established it, Ray. A calling card of Codemasters from like 8-bit and 16-bit is weird-shaped cartridges, which I'm such a fucking giant fan of.
Yes.
I used to have Cosmic Spacehead, which is like this weird Genesis. I was on the Genesis, but it was like this weird like hybrid adventure game platformer. Not very good at all. And it had like a really ugly art style. And it was just kind of a bad game. But the most memorable thing to me about it was it came in this very oddly shaped cartridge that was like, so it had like rounded, really rounded corners and then flat on the top. And the bottom, but the top was more narrow than the bottom, so to speak. Like almost like imagine like a dome,
right?
And then cut the top off of the fucking thing for no good reason, and that's what this game looked like. And it was, you know, having that next to your virtual racing for the Genesis was always kind of fun because like, oh, look at these weird shaped
like
things.
Two trophies.
Yeah. So yeah, one of the Codemasters differences is weird shaped cartridges.
Well, and like, you know, everything they're doing at this time is just, it's so interesting to me because there's no, like, there's obviously no law. telling them they can't make games for these systems.
Right.
Well, there's just the manufacturers.
Well, exactly. Like they're
forcing them.
They're
out.
Made up laws.
Yeah.
Like they're corporate side laws.
Yes.
And on the Power Hour, we've talked about unlicensed games before, especially of this era. Like on the Razorsoft episode, we talked about Stormlord, which was the first unlicensed game that came out on the Genesis. And that very shortly after that came out, then EA started doing their thing. So think about that. Electronic Arts, one of the biggest fucking companies in the world, and Codemasters is pretty big, but they are not even a pimple on EA's ass. And EA got their start making fucking unlicensed games for the Genesis.
Yeah. They were basically like, look, we can make a game for this.
Yeah.
And we're going to find... Whereas EA had a little bit more of a professional route to releasing
Codemasters
kind of said
EA never had a dick darling, whatever. But they did have a guy named Trip, so fuck you.
fair enough
but at the end of the day, like, their companies, like, if so, the platform holders, like your Segas and your Nintendos, were like, you guys need to play ball and release these games using this protocol, and you need to give us X amount of dollars for the privilege or the right to be able to make games on our thing.
Yeah, they were pimps.
Yeah, exactly. They were fucking pimps. And these guys were just like, fuck you, we're renegades. We're going to go ahead and figure that shit out and produce products. And there is no lot of that stuff. And that's where we can now logically segue to the Game Genie, because this is where Nintendo was like, no, fuck you. There are laws for this shit, and we're going to try to make this happen via a lawsuit.
Well, and Sega jumped on board with that.
Well, Sega was like, no, license, like, what? Because here's the deal. The NES Game Genie, when it came out, was a phenomenon.
Yeah.
It came out, obviously, before the Genesis and the Super Nintendo one.
Oh,
it
blew up.
And Sega saw how popular the device was and was like, wait, no, we can make a dollar off this, so let's fucking license it. And use a little bit of our name recognition to help sell the Game Genie, which is what they did.
Wow. So they, wait, Sega licensed
on the Genesis? Game. Yeah.
Okay.
Sega licensed the Game Genie because it, like, again, like this, if it's a successful product, Uncle Sega is one of the
guys. I was just about to say, like, that is the logical conclusion for how that would have played out.
Right. So when the NES,
Sega would come up from taking a hit and being like, we got a deal.
Yeah.
We
got to make a deal with these guys.
Get Codemasters on the phone.
We need to get our 7%.
Yeah.
And they did. And boy, did they. The Game Genie comes out on the NES, and it's a huge deal. Like, you can... First of all, what was your first experience with the NES Game Genie?
Battletoads.
I think that's probably 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
9 out of 10 people were like, oh, Game Genie, Battletoads.
Yeah.
Because this is the only way you're going to fucking beat that game.
That's exactly right. And I did with Game Genie.
Yeah, of course. And that's, like, I don't think it can be overemphasized. Like, when you're a kid and all you have are these hard-ass fucking 8-bit NES games.
Oh, yeah.
That you now have a thing that you can buy that allows you to beat these motherfuckers. Like, it's so awesome.
That's, you know, every person our age now that was a kid that was playing games back then.
Yeah.
You know, might have had a library of maybe 10 games, and 6 of them they hadn't beat.
Right.
Ever.
Yeah, because these they were really hard.
And we all put hours in.
Yeah, we all tried. Yeah. We fucking tried to beat them.
Really hard.
And I remember as a kid just getting so frustrated with games that I couldn't beat. And to have this device come over and just change everything. Like, it's there isn't really an analog to it now unless you, like, look at, like, I guess, like, the mod community. Or, like, you could, like, there's certain things that, like, on PC you can use. And, you know, I don't really do this stuff myself because I'm not a big PC guy. But there's, like programs and bots that you can download for specific games that kind of, like, do the cheating for you.
Right.
But it's very much like, it's just not the same experience as what a Game Genie was.
Well, and part of that is because, just to put context around it, is like, games back then, there were no controls like that. There were no manipulating a game. There were no mods.
No, it was like, this is a solid state of a thing as it gets. Like, yes. This is the thing. It's on a microchip that's on a PCB that's in plastic. That's it.
Yeah, this was the first time on a console where you could manipulate the code to get something you wanted.
Right, and it was a huge deal. And so the way it worked was it would go in through the hexadecimal code of games where like certain information was stored, such as like, you know, like if a game was timed, like the timer, lives, the health.
Life count that you start with.
All that other stuff. And so you putting in, I believe they were 8-digit codes on a hexadecimal system. So that's 0 through 1 and then A through H, I believe.
Something like that.
You would input that. And it was a pain in the ass to fucking put them in. Let's not mince words here. Like it was kind of an annoying thing because you're always like looking at the code to make sure you got it right. Well, if it didn't work, you're always like double checking your work, basically.
You also had like a book of codes that applied to different games. Yeah, and, like some of them like were getting updated or added.
Well, you could so you could subscribe to it was a quarterly, if I'm not mistaken, a subscription to where they would, because new codes were being created all the time,
right?
Because a hexadecimal was something that was very widely understood by people who fucking knew how to code. So they could have like people who were like discovering codes and like print them in this like publication that was sent to you. And then there's another way for Dick Darling to get paid is to, you know, for I think it was $10 for a year and you were sent 4 books. I did that with the Super Nintendo Game Genie, and it was awesome because, you know, it's before the internet. There's no way for you to look up your stuff.
Please tell me that there was a about the author page on the back with a picture of Dick Durbin. Yeah.
Dick Durbin, I wish.
Sorry, Dick Durbin. God, that would be good.
It would be.
Dick Darling.
It's Dick Darling.
Dick Darling's just as good, though.
No, it's way better. It's Dick Darling.
Dickie D.
Just anecdotally, too, I remember my shitty cousin. He had a birthday. It was around the time that the Game Genie first came out, the NES Game Genie. And I went with my mom to go buy one. And because I already had mine at that point. Hello. Right.
but we were no dummy.
I was no dummy. Yeah. But we went to like fucking 3 or 4 different stores trying to buy it. And it was sold out everywhere.
Yeah, I remember it being on like a ton of commercials.
Yeah. With the Micro Machines guy fucking slinging it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Fast
Talker.
There was a point where like there were more commercials about Game Genie than there were about games coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because that year, it was the thing to get.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it was kind of like this, you know, almost like a Tickle Me Elmo kind of a thing. Not to that level, because video games hadn't really, like, exploded yet.
Yeah.
But, like, for kids who were into games and played games, it was, I would just assume, and again, pulling numbers out of my butt here, but I would assume that, like, sales-wise, that game, when the Game Genie was released, it was probably one of the top-selling video game accessories that you could buy.
Yeah, I would assume the same thing.
Yeah. And that, so the original Game Genie on the NES had this really weird, so the thing that you put in your NES was like half cartridge size, yes, so to speak. Like, so like take an NES cartridge,
cut it in half
and then paint it gold. And that's what it was. But it had this weird like carriage almost thing, like black plastic so it would go against the cartridge when you slid it together. And then you put the whole thing into your NES and the game would actually stick out of your NES.
Yeah.
And it looked, you know, pretty dumb. But at the same time, what's funny about it is that when you put the Game Genie in your NES, you couldn't push down.
Yeah, no, it just sticks out like an ugly sore.
Right, but because of the way the NES is designed, the whole pushing down of the thing is like what makes the NES over time break.
Right.
So a lot of people would have great success prolonging their NES's life
by
just
using
a Game Genie, not even necessarily putting in codes. Just leave your game. That's how I use mine. Like, I just left my Game Genie in the NES all the time.
You know, Sega gets a lot of credit for lock-on technology, but it was actually Codemasters.
Yeah, that's true.
That were
the forefathers.
The forefathers.
Without Dick Darling, you would not have your precious Sonic Dick and Knuckles, Darling. Right? So you should pray to the altar.
God,
that is Dickie
name
D.
Name is so good.
We're gonna say it 3,000 times more. So fucking strap in, listener. Strap the fuck in.
Dickie D. We should remix the video so every time we actually say his name,
mm-hmm,
it get like the audio gets lower.
Yeah.
And echoes.
Dick Darling.
Yeah, dude, Game Genie was just freaking huge.
Yeah, it was a phenomenon.
And it was huge on the NES, it was huge on the Genesis. One of the things that I wanted to bring up about the Game Genie, and it's not about Codemasters, mm-hmm, or the Game Genie at all, but it's the first way I experienced Game Genie, mm-hmm, and that Blockbuster, in its infinite wisdom, decided to rent Game Genies.
Oh, yeah.
And so you could go and rent one. And that's how I beat Battletoads, was I rented Game Genie for the specific purpose of beating Battletoads.
Exactly.
Which I went home and did.
See, now if I'm Dick Darling, I'm white hot over this.
Yes.
Because like I want to sell you a Game Genie. But the fact that you could rent it, it's like you rent a Game Genie in a weekend and you're fucking done. Like the dishes are done.
Dude, you know Blockbuster went to Double D and he was like, okay, hey, we want to buy 100 units or 1,000 units of these things. And he was like, no. You're going to buy 1,000 units and then you're going to pay me 20% of every rental.
Yep. We got a cut.
Yeah.
We get a fucking chop of that, pal.
Or you could forget it.
Yeah. I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
So it's
100% accurate.
I want to point out a couple features of the 16-bit Game Genie ones, and then we're going to talk about the lawsuit. So with the Genesis Game Genie and the Super Nintendo one, with a little modification, you can use them as import devices, which rules.
Like by loading like new firmware on it?
No. Let's take Genesis for the example.
Okay.
So Mega Drive cartridges are shaped differently. Mega Drive, of course, Japanese Genesis. The way you plug in a game on the Genesis Game Genie is just put that fucker on there. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like there's no limitations. The sky's the limit. It's super there.
Guaranteed Codemasters went out of their way to make sure that any cartridge fit on the Game Genie.
Yeah, we're selling these fuckers to Japan, too.
Yeah.
So don't you forget it. With the Super Nintendo, so you just basically put a Mega Drive game on a Game Genie, and like I'll say 7 out of 10 times it'll work. There are some Mega Drive games that just won't boot on a Genesis no matter what.
Oh.
But the majority of them do. And on the Super Nintendo...
That passes the Codemaster quality control test.
7 out of 10? 7 out of 10.
Ship it.
That's our platinum rating. Seven out of 10. Shipped.
Print this. Ship it out.
That's exactly right. with the Super Nintendo one, you do have to cut out there's like plastic tabs that you have to just cut out. And they're like, if you look at a Super Nintendo game versus a Super Famicom game, like you'll see exactly where the tabs come into play. So just snip those fuckers out.
Yeah.
If you're like me and you don't give a shit,
you don't need those.
You just take some needle nose pliers and just literally rip them out.
If it was up to Codemasters, those would have never been included. Oh,
exactly.
Anyways.
Yeah, exactly. They tried. They tried to fucking get those things the nicks, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Those are neat little Swiss Army knife like tricks that the Game Genie provides. So let's talk about the lawsuit. That's we teased it a little bit earlier. Nintendo was not on board. Now, they were not like Uncle Hot Cash Sega.
Yeah.
They did not want this thing out there.
Yeah, I had thought Sega was part of it too, but now I as you mentioned, I remember that they licensed the
Game Genie. Yeah, it's this goddamn gold seal right on that thing.
God damn it, is Sega of America in the early 90s not on top of their game?
Yeah.
Jesus, every time you turn around, those guys are making smart Coke in fueled decisions.
Welcome to the next level, Ray.
Yeah.
But so Nintendo takes Galoob to court. Galoob is basically like they're like the grown up in the room. They're the money bags.
Imagine being the defense lawyer for that.
Mm-hmm.
Who's defending Galoob? I am, sir.
Hopefully that attorney talked very quickly.
Yeah. Because
that's the only way that the company understands things.
Yeah.
It's just speed talking. Yeah. So the lawsuit is kind of important for a couple of reasons. Number one, it was a loss. It was a famous loss for Nintendo.
Yeah.
And Nintendo's always been a very litigious company. Like, they will fucking defend their shit.
And they have a good record.
And they have and they do have a really good record. But this time, like, so the argument was, it is illegal to modify code. At the end of the day, like, that's like the layman's, you know, argument of what they're having in the lawsuit.
Right.
And they were saying, on the Game Genie side, is like, well, fuck you. The customer bought this code, and now they can do whatever the hell they want with it. They're not like repackaging the code to be redistributed or like used for any commercial reason. It's like literally like end user put in cheat code, done. Like that's how the experience works.
Yeah. Codemasters is coming into the courthouse and saying like, hey, when I buy a book, I can put notes in it.
That's exactly right. That's like that is the analogy. So even you who bought fucking Battletoads, who's never going to beat Battletoads, like, sorry, like, you're never going to beat this game, and it's illegal for you to use the fucking Game Genie. Like, that's what they were trying to say. So Nintendo loses this, and it's kind of important if this case never happened, right? Like, if Nintendo had won this case and made it so, like, it is illegal for anyone to modify the code that we sell, what would happen to like things like, you know, the modern day like mod community.
Yeah, because this set the legal precedent for why modding existed.
Yes.
And exists today, but also why it hasn't been challenged.
Yeah.
Because the precedent was already set.
Yeah.
That when somebody buys the code from somebody, as long as they're not redistributing their notes or edits,
yeah,
for money, that it's okay.
Yeah. And I honestly think that if this thing, you know, if Nintendo wins and it stops here, like things like games like fucking Counter-Strike, like things that we know that were like spun, or Dota, like things that are spun out as mods,
yeah,
like they just wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's gnarly to think about that. Like that's fucking Dick Darling is,
yeah,
is kind of a, he's coming out here like a hero.
Yeah.
You know,
we owe it all to Dick.
We definitely owe it all to Dick. So,
and think about this, like Steam has modding communities, right? Like readily available, easy to add onto the game.
Yeah.
Like they go out of their way to make sure that those communities, the products that those communities are making are available
to anybody
who owns the code.
They're like supplied with tool sets to be able to fucking, you know, mod games.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a cool point of video game history from, you know, like a legal precedent standpoint that I think is super fascinating.
I will say that we have no idea how much Dick Darling is still involved with the company at this point in the mid-90s.
100%. It's 100%.
But
even if that's not true, it's 100%.
But as you'll see in the early 2000s, when we get to that point, Codemasters kind of starts to develop into a more like, I don't want to say legit, but I'm going to say legit company in terms of not trying to game the system anymore.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure that's about the time Dick Darling left.
Ah, see, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But I
can't prove that with the research that I did.
Right.
But, you know, I can kind of infer that.
Yeah. Like, it's one of those things where, like, you don't know it, but you do know it.
So coming out of the 90s, and I think this is a game that you played a lot, they actually partnered with Jester Interactive to make a music generation game.
Like a music generator game?
Music generator
yes.
game. For the music generation. How about that?
Okay. How about that indeed?
That game came out for the PS2. And
PS1, my man.
Oh, it came out for PS1.
So
it also came out for PS2 and PC. And
yeah, there was a couple sequels for it. The main one, though, my bread and butter, is MTV Music Generator.
Okay, and the first one.
The first one. And when you're doing the research on this stuff, and I had no idea that Codemasters was behind this. And it was like yet another like notch in their belt for me. It was like, God damn, I have spent a lot of time playing Codemasters shit. But
we all low key have spent a lot of time playing Codemasters. Yeah,
exactly. That's the best part.
How good they are.
They're like a fucking really famous character actor. Like they've been in like 3,000 movies, but you don't know their name. But with MTV Music Generator, holy shit, did I like just waste hours of my life making horrible techno just to be funny.
So I've never played this game, but I imagine it as a like souped up, legit version of like the Music Maker on Mario Paint.
Yeah, almost. I mean, like if you're familiar with like what a sequencer looks like. And first of all, I need this to be on the record. I made techno music because I like to laugh at techno music. It's not that I'm a fan. I do think it's funny though to like try to make my own jock jams.
That has been placed in the record.
Thank you. Thank you for placing that. And heavy metal is the final answer, and that's all I need to say about the matter.
Metal. Substance of strength and honor.
Exactly. But creating your own jock jams is a really fun thing to do, and that's all I would do. So all of my shit would have like a bunch of stabs, like bow, bow, and then a bunch of like
bass.
Yeah. Oh, baby. Like that kind of stuff. But hours and hours of my life sunk into that shit.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it rules.
And you had no idea this was a Codemaster game.
No clue. No clue until you fucking hit me with that knowledge bomb.
Yeah.
Isn't that
kind of crazy?
No, fucking rules, man.
So at this time, they also, I don't know what was going on with Acclaim at this time, because I didn't have time to like go back and match it with like kind of their timeline.
Well, Acclaim in the early 2000s is dying.
Right.
They go bankrupt, I believe, in 2003 or 2004 is when they get they just get fucking gutted and IPs are sold off. You could fucking buy desks if you wanted to buy desks. So here's a quick story about Acclaim, and like, well, I'm sure we're going to do an Acclaim episode at some point.
Oh, we have to.
But I was in college when this shit was going on, and I was on. There was an auction website, not like an eBay thing, but like an actual like an
legit
asset
auction house.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was like an
assets.
Yeah, almost like an estate kind of a thing, right? Yeah. But you could buy like the coffee maker. You could buy like fucking chairs that were in the offices. But then you could also buy IP that Acclaim owned, and some of that stuff was like. I mean, I was a college student, so there's no fucking way I could have bought it.
Right.
But, like, it was, like, affordable. Like, you know, like, low four figures kind of stuff. So, like, I would look at stuff and be like, yeah, I should get going on this. Like, just buy. And I'm trying to think of some shitty Acclaim thing that they had.
You can own the K in Acclaim for $4,000.
Even though it's C's?
Yeah, whatever.
They would try to sell you the K. Of course they would. Dick Darling. He's behind it all.
Okay. That rules that I said that.
Yeah, fuck yeah. Not editing that out.
No, that's going in.
That stays.
Acclaim would be better spelled with the K.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So in any case, so at the time that Acclaim was falling apart, like a lot of the directing managers came over to Codemasters.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of lays into some of the transition that's sort of going on in the early 2000s.
Right.
Because MTV Music Generator is something like, it's a legit game. It's kind of like different than anything they had kind of done up to that point.
Yeah.
In terms of it being like completely licensed.
A partnership
with MTV.
MTV's fucking MTV in the 90s, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So after they started bringing on these Acclaim people, they started releasing a lot of games in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all legit games. A lot of them were original IP games. None of them we would recognize here in the U.S. at all.
Mm-hmm.
One that might be a little bit recognizable is they released a massive online multiplayer game around Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Shadows of Angmar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know who I read Lord of the Rings. I don't know what Angmar is.
Yeah, I have no clue.
But it must be a thing.
I did not read. I have seen the pictures, and that is as far as my relationship goes with Lord of the Rings.
Got it. Okay, so apparently I've never played this game. I don't even think I've heard of it.
Yeah.
But from what I was reading about, it was somewhat popular in Europe.
Okay. I was just gonna ask that. It was like a popular thing.
It seems like it.
Okay.
Because there were updates later made to the games, and also re-releases and like add-ons and extras and stuff like that. One of the things that I think it's probably about time for us to get into is because we kind of skipped over some of the early games that they had, just following some of the lineage of the business relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2008, they bought the Formula One rights, and the previous owner of that was Sony. So they took over the Formula One sites from Sony, which is crazy when you think about where Codemasters came from, that by 2008 they're buying the rights of the Formula One series. But to understand that, we should probably go back and look at their history of racing games, because they were actually releasing racing games prior to that transaction happening.
Yeah, and like we talked a lot about the Game Genie and like, you know, some of the more like the Dick Darling side of Codemasters for a long time, and then
we're sadly leaving that era.
Yes, we are sadly leaving that era, and like, you know, your MTV Music Generators and whatnot. But by the late 90s, Codemasters is now like becoming synonymous with racing games. So the first one that they did, of major prominence, and I'm talking like polygonal 3D racing games,
right?
They did the port of the Toka Touring Car Championship for Windows. That's 1997. The following year, they come out with a little game in 1998 called Colin McRae Rally.
Right.
So, and that's like the Colin McRae series evolved into what's going on, still going today, as Dirt. Just, you know, straight, hey, we're Dirt.
Yep.
But Colin McRae was attached to that series before he passed away. And I think he died sometime in the, like, I want to say like 2008, 9, 10.
Yeah, and they released a series of Colin McRae games.
Tons and tons and tons. And they became the rally racing game.
Yep.
Your Gran Turismos would have rally modes and all that shit like that. But like your dedicated rally racing game series was the Colin McRae series. And they also did, this one I actually played a lot of. It was called Insane. And it was like this like kind of open world fucking... truck racing game. I think you played it a lot with our mutual friend Peter, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, you know what? You're right.
Yeah. That was a Codemasters game too. God. And that was all, you know, just drive anywhere. You're in the mud and the dirt and what have you.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
And they like there was just a certain style that was kind of happening at this time. So we're, you know, 98 up through the early 2000s.
Right.
Where like they started making like the most well-known rally stuff within the Colin McRae series, but then like with Insane, like they're really showing off like, hey man, we're good at this. Like we're really, really good at fucking making cars drive around on dirt and having it feel really fun.
Well, in the McRae series kind of led them into all the modern games that they make now. Right. So like we started the whole racing conversation off in 2008 when they bought the F1 rights from Sony.
From Sony, yeah.
But they were making all these games before, and those games were super popular in Europe.
Oh yeah. Well, rally racing is fucking super popular in Europe.
Exactly. And so just like EA makes a ton of money with FIFA, like outside of the US.
Right.
Like that's kind of what Codemasters is doing with racing games. And it solidifies Codemasters as kind of like this really renowned developer and celebrated developer in the UK.
Right.
They recently were recognized as like one of the premier developers of the UK and things like that.
Right? Yeah.
So they're kind of making their name, which is totally outside of like our contextual experience here in the US.
Right.
But they were onto some big stuff like by the late 90s, coming off of the success of these things like Game Genie and J-Cart and like all kinds of other crazy stuff they were doing.
It's like a rags to riches kind of a fucking story, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and we've covered other developers that had kind of like gotten hot and like simmered out.
Right.
And these guys got hot and actually invested it in some proper...
Yeah. they actually did some good business with it, you know? So in between some of these racing releases that they're, you know, becoming famous with, they did a couple of action games. One that I played a fair amount of was called Second Sight. I played it on the GameCube. And it was like this really cool first-person shooter-y kind of thing where you could, like, see things through the perspective of someone else, hence Second Sight.
Right.
It had, like, a kind of a cool, like, sci-fi storyline to it.
I remember Second Sight.
Yeah, it was a neat game.
That was a Codemaster game?
Yeah. It was not only, it was published by Codemasters, too.
Oh, wow.
So that in the 2000s is when Codemasters is now, like, turning into a publisher as well.
Yeah.
And that's just fucking Colin McRae money right there.
Yeah.
that's what that shit is.
Totally. Colin McRae money is bigger money than Game Genie money.
Yes, I think so as well.
So, and then the other interesting fact about 2008 for Codemasters is not only did they get the F1 license and kind of took it away from Sony, but they actually bought Sega's arcade studios from Sega.
Yes,
in Europe, and at this time, Sega racers were far removed from all the classics that AM2 made.
Yeah, for
sure. And they were doing like Sega GT and these other things, and a lot of those were being developed out of their developer in their development house in Europe, where those which makes sense because that's where a lot of those games were really popular.
Right.
And so Codemasters bought that studio from Sega, and so you can kind of argue that all the racers that, well, not all of them, we can't claim that for Dirt.
Right.
But we can certainly claim it for another one that, you know, a lot of these racing games that Codemasters is making today can be considered the spiritual successor to the Sega racers.
Yeah, at least to some degree, for sure. So what were the that studio that they bought from Sega? What were they responsible for?
So Sega Racing Studio in Europe had a part in at least overseeing Sega Rally Revo.
Oh, okay.
Which was like an abysmal failure.
Yeah. I think Sumo Digital, the guys who did the Sonic Transformed Racing series, it was a Sonic All-Star Racing, and then the sequel was Transformed.
Right.
Pardon me. And I think they're also working on the what is going to be guaranteed piece of shit.
Yes.
That new Sonic Racing game that's coming out.
Yeah. God, why did they decide to take such a step back?
I don't know.
Oh man.
but they did.
You know what's better than a game with all the memorable Sega characters? Hmm. A game with all the unmemorable Sonic characters.
Yeah, Sonic and all of his shitty friends in a racing game. God. Yeah, let's take out fucking cool shit like the dwarf from Golden Axe and put in Amy.
Yeah.
No.
No.
Don't need it.
Yeah.
Don't need it. Don't want it.
Don't want it.
So
give me my Panzer Dragoon fucking racing levels, you assholes.
You assholes. I totally agree. I can't agree with something harder than that right there. Yeah. But okay. But back to Codemasters and the Sega relationship. So they Sega. What was it, what's the official name of them again? Sega Racing Team. Sega Racing Studio. So they did a little bit of work on Sega Rally Revo. Was there anything else that they did of note? Because like, and the reason why I want to talk about this is because, okay, if Codemasters today is like one of the last. Or I shouldn't say last, like one of the major racing game developers.
Right.
And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that without question is Sega. Well, actually, fuck, it's like 2019. So it's like fucking like 25 years ago.
So whatever date. So this is what I learned in my old age. Whatever date you think it is, right. Add 10 years and that's probably more accurate.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, like, you know, at one point in time, Sega was like just fucking dominant in that genre.
Dominant. So the studio they bought, this isn't like the guys that made Daytona or made the original Sega Rally or whatever.
Yeah, that's AM2.
But these are the guys that like had, you know, like done like Sega GT and some of the like Dreamcast, PS1 or
PS2
or PS2 era racers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sega Rally Revo was supposed to be basically the relaunch of Sega Rally, and it just failed. And I think you're right. Sumo made the games, Sega Racing Studio oversaw it and was responsible for it, as well as like trying to produce some other games that eventually Sega just scrapped it all and sold it to Codemasters.
There was a Sega Rally 2006.
Yes.
Was that this studio?
I believe so.
Okay. All right. So either that or there's some permutation. At the end of the day, the bottom line, a piece of Sega Racing is now under the Codemasters umbrella.
Correct.
Which
is kind of cool.
It's neat, yeah.
All roads lead back to Sega.
Always.
That's
always,
what I say.
Always in fucking forever. So, okay, we should figure out a way to wind this package down. We've been all over the place, jumping schizophrenically, but I think hopefully it's followable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the only kind of notable thing since for people that are listening in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and we have one.
and we love you.
You know, Codemasters is a known entity over there, right?
It's a known entity here too. I mean, like,
it is.
Very contemporary, very in the now Codemasters bit to talk about.
Ooh.
And the recent Nintendo Direct that, you know, as we record this, aired I think a week ago. One of the big, you know, third-party reveals is that Grid is coming to the Nintendo Switch.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, you know, now we're going to start to see some of their... We're going to see some of Dick Darling rub off on Nintendo's newest platform.
I can't wait. I can't wait. That's awesome. You know, I think the only other thing of note that I would want to talk about is because it is like a UK kind of quote-unquote treasure. It is the oldest developer in the UK, established developer in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, like shortly after they had kind of made these acquisitions, they were actually purchased by an Indian company.
Okay.
And they had a majority stake for a while. But then they released their IPO, I think, a couple of years ago and like rebought themselves back.
Oh, okay.
So now it's UK-owned again.
You're talking about Reliance Media out of India,
yeah, Reliance
right?
Media out of India bought them.
Okay.
But
you just said like they've been
they bought themselves back,
got
essentially.
It. Okay.
So
full,
you know,
power.
Yeah, no, it's just, you know, kind of interesting to kind of think like there was other dynamic. I don't know any other part of that story. Like, I don't know if it was just them like wanting to make some sort of investment into this company, but then like I don't know if they had any influence over the games or anything, but just, you know, kind of a quirk of history.
Yeah, and it's just the business, the back end business thing. I think to me, and as we kind of put a button on this. So I think so Codemasters today synonymous with racing games, but to have this company who started out as just about as fucking carny as it gets. And,
yep.
And be able to fucking survive and thrive is I can't think of like another company that did that. I mean, we talked about Electronic Arts. That is like the genesis of the Electronic Arts is kind of starting that same way. So it's those two. But like, you know, the fine people that made the Action 52, like they're not still here. Yeah, not still here.
So I would say Codemasters is a great story of if you really believe in what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and people are telling you it's not legal, don't listen to them. They don't know what they're talking about. You can still be successful.
What a beautiful moral.
And with that,